Awesome. So here we are back at it on the Monday evening, a wild card with Winfrey located in Sedona, Arizona, a 1 hour show. Good evening to you. Today it is January the 25th, 2021. My name is Gijs Minderhout, located in California. And let's see what's going to happen tonight. I welcome you all. We had someone else join in. Welcome. Please say your name and location.
It's Wynn in Sedona.
Hello, Wynn. Welcome.
Good evening, Wynn.
Good evening. Is that Wanda?
Yeah.
I'm just making sure I recognize that beautiful voice.
Yes, thank you.
You sound closer tonight, Wanda, than you usually do.
Yeah.
Oh, must be the wind.
Could be, yeah.
Is Molly in Silverado, California?
Yes. Well, sort of. My phone says I am.
I thought you were in Riverside.
I'm in Corona.
Welcome to the next caller. Please say name and location.
Hi, it's Terry in Nevada.
Hi, Terry. Good evening to you. Welcome.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, Terry.
Hi.
I'm just on the other side of a hill.
Huh?
Sorry. Excuse me.
Welcome to the conference call. Please say name and location.
Oh, hi, everyone. Shirley from Ohio.
Hey, Shirley. Good evening. Welcome.
Hello, Shirley.
And welcome to the next caller. Thank you for being here. Good evening. Welcome to the conference call. Please say your name and location.
Hi, this is Terry in Sedona.
Welcome, Terry.
Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Good evening, Terry.
Hello, Wanda.
It's snowing here. Wow.
Yeah, now tomorrow you'll be able to watch the crystals on the windows like I do.
Yeah.
It's very cold in here in California.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nevada, too. A lot of rain. Nice.
Yeah, bring whatever you want in, because you're going to be getting snow, they say.
Okay. Bring it on.
You know, you guys have a treat coming up for you, because Terry Marie, never mind.
Good evening. Welcome to the conference call. Please say your name and location.
Roger in Austin.
Hey, Roger.
Welcome, Roger.
Hi, Roger.
Hello, Roger.
Hi, everybody.
And the next caller, welcome. Please say your name and location.
Hi, it's Joni in St. Louis.
Hi, Joni.
Hi, Joni. Good evening. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. Thank you.
What were you saying, Wynn?
I'm going to play one of your songs pretty soon.
Oh, cool. Great. Thank you.
Hey, do this same guys live 30 years?
Good evening. Welcome to the conference call. Please say your name and location.
Hi. It's Jennifer from Greensburg. Hi, everybody.
Welcome,
hi,
Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, everyone.
What'd you say, Wayne? I didn't catch that.
Oh, wait a second.
Someone else, good morning, welcome. What's your name and location?
I don't know, in Ohio. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Don, welcome.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Don.
Jennifer, are you home during...
Boy.
Jennifer. Are you home during the day normally?
Yes.
You are?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you pick up your phone?
Maybe. Quite as well. I didn't answer it, but I don't know the number.
I have to unblock my number, right?
Yeah, you probably should.
No, I did get your email from yesterday, and I sent you. Go ahead.
Did you see that email about earthquakes?
Mm-hmm. I'm aware of that. That's why I used two sources and more.
But there were a couple of big earthquakes that you didn't mention. Did you know that?
Apparently, yes.
They might not become a... Terry is an expert on this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, everybody. Are we on BBS now?
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Let's get started. I'm going to do a replay tonight.
All right.
And
today it is...
Don't start the recorder quite yet, okay?
Okay.
Muted.
It's the 25th, and we have 48 minutes left.
Don't start me yet. Okay, here we go.
No.
You can start, okay?
Yeah, okay. Here we go. 48 minutes left.
The recording has started.
This is January 25th, 2021. Everybody everywhere. And our Monday night wildcard night. And I'm going to play back one of our classic calls. And I've been trying and I've prepared myself tonight, so it should work. Carlo Rucker, you know, two people who are kinds of legends on our calls are Carla Rucker and Daphne. And everybody knows who they are, but I'll tell you just in case. Daphne is the woman who was my, I'm not supposed to call her a girlfriend, my personal relationship that was driving on the road to Portland when I did the prayer protection and said, does anybody want to talk to me? And suddenly there was an answer. And that was the beginning of all of this. And for 6 months, she would just tap me on the shoulder and tell me, those guys want to talk to you again. And during the period, even before I met Daphne, I met Carla Rucker. And Carla Rucker is the person who I got exposed to through David Wilcock when I was writing the book, and he referred to her all the time because she had channeled a classic legendary group of channelings that's called the Raw Material. And if any of you haven't read that or tried to read it, you know, the thing with it is either it will get to you and it'll be compelling and you won't be able to put it down, or it won't. But it's some of the deepest, most profound channelings about the history of the universe and the rock group's participation in it. And Carla has passed away, but she and I became friends. And in fact, when Daphne was channeling, I kept calling Carla and said, what do you think of this? I would read them to her. I was afraid maybe it was negative, there was something wrong with it. And then prior to her leaving this realm, for 5 years, she was my co-host on our Sunday healing calls. So I found something with Daphne, Carla, and Terry. And hang on just a second here. And this was March in 2013. And I'm not sure what we talked about, but it's got good volume, and it's a rare thing to get everybody together. Although when Terry would be on the line and Carla and Daphne would be on, usually Terry would be pretty quiet in the background. Isn't that right, Terry? Are you there? You want to say anything to anybody?
Yeah, I usually wouldn't say much. Sometimes Carla would try to get me to talk a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, here we go.
Hello, everybody. Everybody on our line, everybody on our calls, everyone on the internet. This is Winfrey, and this is our Monday night call. Let's see if Terry's there. Terry, are you there?
Yes, here I am. Hi, everybody. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Terry. How are you?
I am great.
Hey, I like the pictures that Win sent me of the two of us.
Yes, they turned out really, really well.
I know. I usually spoil pictures, but your radiance transformed me.
I wish you would do that for me. Please.
No, you're just
you look good.
So, what is this forum?
What is it?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we...
Terry, who is that? This is Win in real time. Terry? Oh, she disappeared again.
Yeah,
well,
I hit the mute. No, wasn't there the guy in Santa Barbara that we went to see?
Is Barry Morrow?
Wasn't that Barry Morrow? Because we had our pictures taken together, Barry and I, and...
Maybe it was. Maybe I had him on this call. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
Okay. Yeah.
Barry Morrow is the guy that produced The Rain Man. And if the world lasts long enough, who knows? We still may make a movie. But
hey, just a second. I'm just tuning in here to, let's see. Just a moment. Every Monday, we have a conference call, and it's broadcast on the internet, and there's a number of people who have been paying attention to my work, and we've been doing this Monday night session for quite some time, and it's basically, I don't know, if you're on this planet right now, people have a little anxiety, people don't know what's happening next. And so there's a group of people that have just paid attention to my talk with the Elohim, and this is like a supportive situation. We probably have, we have the call, we have the internet, we have replay lines. We have something like... every call, maybe 300-400 people are listening. In fact, I'll unmute them. Hang on a second. Some of them. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Absolutely.
No.
I can hear you, but
you
haven't
shocked?
Said
you...
anything yet.
Yay, Barry.
Well. What I have learned is there's nothing to say.
All right,
you know,
all right. I'll be patient.
This this is not a normal kind of interview show. Okay? This is like, okay, I skip as normal. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Monday Night with Winfrey. And we have a special guest tonight that we're going to be talking to. His name is Barry Morrow. He is the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of the movie Rain Man. And
that is so cheesy.
Is right.
That echo effect, but I love it. Go on.
Barry happens to have a passion for writing things about crazy people. And he wouldn't call them crazy. He would call them, politically correct word?
I call them mutants.
Mutants.
Of which I aspire to be one myself, because without the mutant, everything stays the same and nothing ever changes. So they're all mutants in some way. They're too smart. They're too heavy. They're too skinny. They're too self-destructive. They're too whatever they are. They're just too much to be called normal. And how can you not find that kind of person interesting? So that's why I write about them.
And, of course, when Barry met me, he thought he hit a home run. Okay.
Well, you're on the grid, and probably the spectrum, too.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I like you. You have no other redeeming qualities, Win, except for your weirdness.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, Barry, here is something somebody emailed me today. They said they saw it on LinkedIn, and they said, wait a second. Oh, maybe you didn't write it. I thought you wrote it, okay? Here, I read this on LinkedIn and copied it down. I wanted to send it off after our last conversation. I thought it was timely considering the call this evening. It reflects us all. Weird is good. Enjoy, Joel. But you know what? I guess you didn't write this. I thought he said you wrote it, okay? He mentioned your name earlier.
I would vote for it. Weird is good, yes.
I'll read this to you. I like when they call me weird. Weird is good. I tell them normal is blah. You don't want to be blah. Blah is boring. Boring people are forgettable. I like weirdos. They are interesting. They have crazy ideas. They have passion. Weirdos separate from the pack. Weirdos change the world. Weirdos read. Weirdos make us think. Weirdos don't see anything as impossible. Anything is possible. Just give us enough time. Weirdos are contrarians. They think differently and act even more differently. Normals try to fit in. Weirdos stick out without really trying. Weirdos aren't driven by money. Money is a destination. Weirdos are all about the journey. Weirdos don't care about what others think. They only care if they think and want to change how they think. Weirdos come in all shapes and sizes, colors and countries, and they're not new to the tech industry or industry in general. Weirdos thought it made sense to get on the Mayflower from England to settle in a new land. Weirdos thought we should get rid of slavery. Weirdos insisted that women should also have a vote. The world would suck if it wasn't for weirdos. Instead of trying to get our kids to fit in, we should help them celebrate why they are different. Let's start to teach kids to embrace weird. Weird is good, and let's not stop until weird is normal. So what do you think, Barry? You didn't like that, huh?
Well, it started off clumsily, but by the time you finished, I have to say I agree with all of it. And I wish I had written it. And if I had written it, Then that's a problem I have, and I have to get fixed because I don't recall it. Sounds like something I might have said, but it was too eloquent and too long, so I doubt that, too. So I just don't know.
You would have said it better if you wrote it, right?
At the beginning, I would have, yeah. Like I say, it started off sort of like a clumsy bird, and then once it got airborne, it just kind of soared. What's the feeling of your group regarding what was said? Because if I didn't write it, I certainly endorse it.
Well, let's see.
Well, one of the things that makes me feel more at home. I never feel quite at home, so it really makes me feel at home. And the other thing of it is my relatives came over on the Mayflower.
There you go. Genetically, you've got...
You're genetically weird.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that there's anything wrong with, you know, average, normal, whatever the word would be, persons, if there are... I mean, it's got to be like four people, but...
Yeah.
It was, you know, and that's weird, too, when you think of it. So...
Okay. Now, listen... Barry, I want to show you something that we figured out on this conference line, okay? And I hope this works, because we've done it before, and, you know, and what I want is I want everybody, I'm going to unmute the lines, I want everyone to give a round of applause for our special guest tonight, Barry Morrow. Just a moment. Okay. We are unmuted. Let's go, guys.
Hard to clap and hold a phone at the same time.
Wow. Whatever that was.
And that's not canned. I could tell. That was pretty real.
That's the sound of one hand clapping, okay?
And so I see, it sounded like everybody had disappeared, but you had simply muted them.
I muted them, yes.
How do they feel about that?
About being muted, about me being in such a control position here?
However you want to frame it, it just seems like, well, it's probably, there'd be too much staticky noise and people, the dog barking and all those wonderful sounds, but it would probably be
too much. You know what? One of the things about having an audience on a conference call is that everything can happen in the background. Like your toilet's flushing. You hear sinks running, you hear cars honking their horn, and you hear wives yelling at their husbands.
My toilet can't possibly flush if I'm on my phone. So if it does, it's the end of the world. Everybody duck and cover.
You are one of the few people. So, you know, I don't know if Barry's going to be available. We were thinking of doing a special call on Saturday with Barry as a fundraiser, but we'll have to check and see if he's available to show up. But I'll tell a little bit about Barry and his escapades with weird people. And it started out, of course, with Rain Man, and there's an incredible real story behind the writing of Rain Man, which we'll touch on. And then he wrote a movie, which, you know, it's interesting. I remember seeing his movies when I was young. It was a TV movie on Karen Carpenter. And I don't know if you guys remember the Carpenters. They were a great singing group. What was their biggest song, Barry?
Oh, we had so many. We've Only Just Begun and Close to Me. And
We've Only Just Begun. Right. And Karen Carpenter was a, one of those people that starved herself? I said, what's the name for that?
Well, first of all, she was, let's put it in the order of importance. She had, by almost everybody's assessment, including, you know, divas like Barbara Streisand, one of the purest pop vocals, voices of its era or any era. And she was oddly a drummer that and her brother was her partner and composer, and he was a pianist, and he basically played a piano and played drums and she sang. And they got discovered by Herb Alpert and others, and became for a good 12 years, maybe not 12, maybe it wasn't that long, but because she died. But at the height of their career, they were everywhere. I wasn't a fan of their music, frankly, until I was really far into the screenplay. I agreed to write it because she died of a very little known disease, Dan, which is now universally known as anorexia. And it's not to say girls weren't, and boys, some, weren't starving themselves to death prior to that, but like Rain Man and autism, you know, these things weren't known or discussed. So, again, I was attracted to the anomaly of a young, good-looking girl with an angelic voice, you know, basically dying from self-starvation. So, then the reason I wasn't a huge fan of their music is everything was, most of it was, that I heard on the radio at least, was sort of up-tempo stuff. And this is during the age of, you know, post-Vietnam and not quite before disco, and lyrics had messages and folk was really the basis of it all. And so the Carpenters for me were not, that was what other people listened to. But I agreed to do the story for other reasons, namely my interest in what had happened to her, and to sort of solve the mystery of it. But as a result, of course, I had to get all the albums and listen to them, which I did night and day throughout the research period and then writing the script. And at the end of which, I realized I was as big a fan as anyone out there of her voice, because no matter how happy the song might be, if you listen hard enough, you'll hear the pain in her life and this grasping for a way out in her voice itself. And then I was hypnotized by her. But anyway, that's the Karen Carpenter story.
Thank you. Now, the movie with Mickey Rooney, that was on TV. What was that called? That was called...
It's a real hard title. It's called Bill.
Bill. That was about the same fellow that was in Rain Man, right?
No, that was the guy that I met just out of college, who was the opposite of Rain Man. Rain Man is pretty much universally known as the person who had more knowledge in his brain than any other human ever. Whereas Bill couldn't read or write, count, didn't even know his last name when I first met him. But he had a social genius that was off the chart. And he took me under... into his world, just with his smile and his just sweet manner. And Bill, I found out, had been institutionalized for 44 years, from age 7 until, you know, well past his midlife, just for being mentally retarded at an age when, if your family was poor and your parents didn't speak English and they were Russian, and you were a little slow, rather than adapt you to the neighborhood or the neighborhood to you, they sent boys like Bill on trains to institutions where he spent nearly half a century. And the miracle of Bill was that he didn't resent one minute of it. He embraced whatever life he had, whatever was around him. And he just never had a bad day in his life, no matter what horrible things happened to him and horrible things did.
but...
Barry, was Bill the guy that was looking out the window when you were walking to school?
No, he wasn't. Well, he was looking out the window, but I was an adult. I mean, I was just out of college, but he was a pot scrubber in the kitchen at a very exclusive, old-moneyed country club where my wife was a waitress. And at night, I would go to pick her up in a parking lot behind the building, and I could see up there to the second-story window the kitchen area. And it was there that I first saw Bill, who, once he saw me, he didn't know who I was, but I was just down there every night. He would wave and smile and pantomime something that was going on in the kitchen, usually having to do with pots or pans or spoons. And we saw each other this way, became friends this way over several hundred feet of distance and through various seasons and well into winter before I actually met him in person. And it was a Christmas party at this country club, and the staff got to, you know, take over the institution, if you will, for the night, and all the members stayed home, and so I was invited in. It was a banquet, sort of Christmas party for the staff, and there he was at the other end of this fairly elaborate, you know, chandeliered banquet hall, sitting alone with a drink of water and a beetle wig on his head. So he was dressed up for the occasion. And he recognized me and stood up immediately and thrust his hand out. And he said, "Hey, buddy, my name's Bill." And so that began a friendship that, I mean, it wasn't planned on my part. The next day he asked me, you know, if he told me he was out of some supplies. He needed toothpaste. Had no way to get toothpaste in his life, so I figured I could do that. And so next day I got him toothpaste, and the day after that I got him reodorant, he called it, and then I got him wig spray for his beetle wig. And then after that I'd lost count. By that time I was just so happy to be with this guy, even though, you know, he could have been my grandfather. Because of his personality and the sunny side disposition he had. And so, I could go on for hours about Bill, and I actually have in different forums. I've done like a stand-up storytelling performance that was recorded in the 90s, and, you know, it was out on CD and stuff. And then I did, of course, in 81. The movie Bill came out, starring Mickey Rooney as Bill, and Dennis Quaid played a very young Barry Morrow, and that's what got me into the business, was just writing the story of our friendship. And it was written just as a story for my friends.
That came out before Rain Man, yes?
Yeah, well before. That was 81, and then there's this sequel in 83, and then I was on to the things like The Carpenter Story and others, which, you know, that I was in television. Then Rain Man was my first foray into feature film.
You see, I didn't know that. I thought Rain Man was first, and the television gene later.
Rain Man was 89, and Bill was 81, so...
I see.
It was a good decade for me. I got a lot of, you know, work, and I've turned a lot of things down, made a few bad choices, but overall it was, you know, it was fun. It was like being, you know, a young baseball pitcher just in his prime and throwing strikes all the time, and, you know, and not that I'm unhappy now. In fact, I'm relieved that, you know, the pressure and the eyes, the expectations aren't on me the way they were when I was younger. But, you know, it was mainly good to be alive in at a time when writers in television and motion pictures could write about people like Bill and Rain Man, or My Left Foot, or Shine, or any number of movies that would never be made today because the studios are not developing anything even remotely like them. They wouldn't do Rain Man today. They wouldn't do Forrest Gump today. So if you're in the movie business and you're trying to get stories told of the kind that I'm attracted to, that resonate with me, and I know a lot of people, then you've got to do independent filmmaking, and that means you don't just write the script, find the story and write the script. You find the people who will pay for it. You find, you know, the agents who will show it to their clients. You have 1,000 emails, 1,000 phone calls, hundreds of meetings, lunches, driving from L.A. to Santa Barbara and back, on and on and on and on, and hope that you can pull it all together and still tell a story the way it was so easy for me to do earlier. And I do it every day because I love to tell a story.
Have you noticed that the music business has done the same thing as the movie business? Seems as much as I pay attention to it, that
I'm not that familiar with the music business like I am film, but certainly it's been set on its head. I mean, from Napster forward, there's very little money to be made recording music, and that was what music always was from, you know, I mean, the first records until then. And now it's hard for young people to break in because the record, there's, you know, nobody's signing you to recording contracts. I mean, unless you want to go American Idol route, but, you know, Bob Dylan was never going to make it past the first cut on American Idol. In fact, he would have been one of the ones they showed how bad you can be. Or Neil Young or Tom Petty or Carol King or anybody with an imperfect voice has a hard time of it today. But in live performing, it's pretty much the only real big revenues sources for music. But will that stop people from making music? No. Even if you don't make a dime for music, if you have to make music, you will make it. And eventually, there will be ways in which society will be able to value that again and allow people to, you know, do that for a living rather than do it as a hobby. But technology is in great flux, and we make a lot of breakthroughs, but that also creates holes in the fabric of what we've taken for granted, and those holes have to be patched, and I'm hopeful that they will.
What do you think of the people like Lady Gaga and Britney Spears and that? Did you see that new Korean guy who has the most hits on YouTube of any video, I believe, 1.5 billion? Have you seen him, Psy?
Yes, I know of all of the people you just mentioned. Lady Gaga is my granddaughter's favorite person, so I can't say anything bad about her.
Okay.
And she doesn't even know who she is. She just likes the name Lady Gaga. So
I think.
But yes, this crazy Korean dude, he got himself in trouble. Turns out, a few years ago, he said a few bad things about the United States and the places that have made him famous. But, you know, he sort of apologized for that. And that's fine. He's like a lot of Asians today, Koreans, Chinese, Taiwanese, not so much the Japanese. They've been hit pretty hard by the economy and, of course, that terrible tsunami. And I think they're just kind of, you know, licking their wounds right now. But the rest of Asia is going crazy with everything, and culture is one of them. And I think, you know, that video is hilarious. I liked it. I wouldn't want to see it more than twice, but...
The Psy video, right?
The Psy video? I don't know.
The Korean fellow. His name is Psy, isn't it Psy?
Oh, whatever his name is, I don't know. He's riding an imaginary horse. We're talking about the same guy.
Right. I was just going to tell people, if they want to go on YouTube, just do a search on Psy, and what's the name of that dance, Terry? Gengen style? And, I mean, what he did is he made a video that has a dance step in it. It looks like he's riding a horse, and a song called Gengen style, which is all in Korean. No one understands it. And it suddenly got 1.5 billion hits, the most hits of anything in video. It became a phenomenon.
Well,
it's Kerry Watson.
It's very high energy, and
yes.
You know, it's mesmerizing in its own way.
I actually like the guy better than some of the other pop stars that seem to get decadent. You know, like there's a decadence that has come in to some of the American pop stars in their major videos. But I didn't see him as being so decadent. Even though, you know, of course he talks about women, he was a little bit innocent in himself. That's the way it seemed. So,
he hasn't been around long enough to become decadent, but...
Right,
you know,
give him a chance.
He's in the entertainment business. He will become decadent. It's almost inescapable. And there's a reason. There's a reason. And it's why you should never envy famous people. Their lives really do get insufferable. Can't go anywhere. You can't do anything. It's like prison. Wherever you go, you're stopped, you're hounded, you're adored, you're followed, you're photographed, you're lied about, and, you know, it's like, wow, I worked so hard to get to the point where I don't have a moment's peace. So you retreat into this fake world that you create, you know, whether it's Michael Jackson's Neverland or Marlon Brando's island in Tahiti, or just a big estate with armed guards, or whatever it is, that's your world. And Tom Cruise has to live in that other world, which is a much smaller world than the one we enjoy. I mean, I think he would probably pay almost anything if he could, like, park his car, go into a Rite Aid drugstore, go down the aisles and look, see what's out there now. Because he hasn't done anything like that in probably 20 years. So the next time you see
For the people that don't know about it, let me just mention this. Tom Cruise was in Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman. It was probably one of Tom Cruise's early movies that helped put him on the map. Could we say that, Barry?
Well, yeah, Risky Business was his first, I believe, or among his first, and that put him on the map. But Rain Man put him on the map called Actors, and he became an actor, really, with
Rain.
And then he quit being an actor. He became an action hero. And
were you on the set when they were making Rain Man, were you not?
Well, one would think, but there was a thing called a writer's strike in 1988, when the picture was made, and so I could not go on the set. No writers were going on sets anywhere, and it was, you know, one of our longer strikes. Now, the last day of filming, which was downtown L.A., I did go. I did go on the set because I knew that I couldn't get into trouble with my the Writers Guild or fellow writers, because the whole point of it is you're not crossing lines to provide services, which in this case would be writing services. So I never did that. But yeah, so I was on the set till the last day, and I only did that in case anybody ever asked me, well, were you on the set? And then I have to tell you, in, what, 22, 3 years, no one has ever asked me that question when until you just did. And instead,
well.
and instead of saying, yes, I was on the set, of course I was on the set, instead I told you the real answer, which is I was on the set for a couple of hours. So there you go.
Hey, were you disappointed with the way the movie came out? I mean, I think the fact that you weren't on the set and it came such a classic, and it really was, seemed so put together. And how come that movie didn't get screwed up if you didn't have, like, even on the set control of it?
Well, you don't know anything about the movie business, I can tell you that.
That's true.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, there are writers who are influential, mainly because of their relationship with the director. The director has been, since the 70s, when the French coined a term, auteur filmmaking. And basically, the auteur, which is the author, was the director. Now, prior to that, a director was a director, and the writer was a writer, and the costumer was a costumer, and, you know, and makeup did makeup. But in the 70s, the director became the author of the film, and they started putting on the top of the film a film by, rather than, you know, directed by, and it really screwed things up, and it's still not back to where it should be. I mean, directing is not like the only thing. It's just one of the things. It takes all of the things to make one thing good or bad. And, you know, there are auteurs, I think. I mean, Woody Allen was an auteur because he wrote, directed, produced, and acted. Sometimes he even did some of the music. And when you do it all, then you are the author of it, no question. But if you are a director who is replacing another director because he just fell ill or got fired, and you come onto the set in the first week of shooting and you pick up where the other person, male or female, left off, and you finish the picture and it comes out and it says, a film by? That's pretty ridiculous. So I'm really opposed to this possessory credit, as it's referred to, a film by.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's directed by someone, it's written by somebody, and here are the actors. And that's the way it should be. But no, my being on the set or not wouldn't have made a whit of difference. Barry Levinson really didn't need me. And do I regret it? Oh, yeah, 4 Oscars later, and the defining moment of my career, not that I don't think I've done as good or better work, but that is it. When? Why would I regret it? I mean, I would just have to be the most biggest sourpuss in the world to look at something that turned out, you know, so good for everybody. And do I have criticisms of it? Of course, you know. And as I do of myself, you know. But, and would I have made it better? I would have tried, but probably not. I mean, anyway, that was all those years ago. I'm not focused on any of that in my life. I'm focused on, like, today.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I want to give people a chance. We have about 12, 13 minutes left. And there's two things I want to do. I want to give people a chance to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a fellow in our group who goes by the name of Mac Boogaloo. And he emailed me and said, you know, he wants to start a Facebook group for all the artists and poets and everything in our group. So I want him to share his vision. So those of you out there that fit that category might want to join his Facebook group. But before we do that, let's just see. Now, I'll bet people are intimidated, Barry. I'll see if anyone actually comes forth and asks a question. I do know there's at least one person, at least one, and probably more, who would say he wants to be an actor and win an Academy Award. And he's out there, and he's actually a good actor. He lives in San Diego. But I won't say who he is unless he does. So if anyone wants to come on and say anything to Barry or ask a question, press star 6. Uh-oh. I knew this would happen. Oh, you can call.
Hi.
Is that Donald? Hi, Donald.
Don from Braxel Highwind.
Yeah.
Hi, Barry.
Hi, Don.
I got a question. Can anybody nowadays, could you still write a screenplay and like get an agent and sell a screenplay nowadays, or is that those days over?
No, you can, because the people who are making movies aside from the studios are, you know, independent producers and mini majors, and you know, there are people. The movie business is bigger than ever, but it's just different in terms of now they're trying to appeal to a world market and they're trying to hit a home run. So $100 million movie is like pretty much where the studios start, whereas a movie like, say, Crash, that won the Academy Award a few years back, I think cost $5 million, and yet it had the big stars because they were all willing to, you know, work at the same low, basically scale rate, and they just believed, you know, in the product. But getting an agent has never been easy. It's a weird. I was told that it's a catch-22, and it's up to you to solve it, which is you can't get an agent until you've had something made, and you can't get something made until you, you know, have an agent. And, you know, I did one of those two things. I got something made without an agent. And even when I had a movie coming out, this first thing, Bill, I couldn't get an agent until it actually did come out, and I won an Emmy. And then all of a sudden, you know, I could get an agent.
Yeah, it probably helps if you get an Emmy.
Yeah. And then so, but nobody was interested the day before I got an Emmy. So, of course, these things are hard. There's so many screenwriters. And since anyone now can, you know, with computers being so easy and screenwriting programs and, you don't have to do anything. You can sit down right now and write the words fade in and start a screenplay. And, you know, like 250,000 people every year do that. And then studios make, you know, what, 30 movies or something. And but there's still hundreds and hundreds of movies made every year. And no
reason.
Can I ask
you one more other, more technical question? You know,
yeah.
Like Sid Field's book, Screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, why does a writer need to write in all the camera shots? I mean, it seems like that would be something the director would do. I never quite got where they
use
the format.
I never write in camera shots. I mean, I might say it's a point of view shot, you know,
mm-hmm.
somebody looking at something.
Yeah, if it's necessary to get the point across of the scene or something.
The more that you try to direct the picture from the script, the further you get away from storytelling and the more you get into the architecture of a movie. And so I wouldn't do it. It just doesn't help the read.
Yeah.
You know, it makes people conscious of it's a movie instead of a story.
Implies, though, that you kind of have to write in that style to get, like, an agent to look at it or get anybody to look at it. So you're saying that's not really true necessarily?
I don't think that's true. No, I mean, all you have to do really is, you know, use the slug line, which is the exterior and interior, whether it's office or house, day, whether it's night. And you have to establish your scenes in the traditional way.
So if I write another screenplay, I can quote you and when I send a letter to my agent?
Yeah, and there's a lot of good it'll do.
You said it was okay that I do that.
You can certainly quote me, yeah.
And I'll remind them that you won an Emmy, so.
Well, and an Oscar.
Don, are you a screenwriter?
I wrote a screenplay years ago. Didn't do anything, but I'm thinking about trying again.
Yeah, well, look, millions of people have written them, and you know what? And that's a very select club. That's an elite club. If you actually wrote a screenplay, as opposed to I am writing a screenplay, which is what most people are really doing. They are writing screenplays, but they don't finish them because they get to the second act, the end of the second act, around page 65, and they collapse because they haven't structured it carefully. And they can't keep moving forward into the third act because there's nowhere to go. And so they just sit there forever, and they never write the words fade out because they never finish it. But if you've actually finished some screenplays, then congratulations, you're already in a relatively small circle.
Barry, speaking to that structure, do you then have an outline prior to engaging in writing the story, or do you just start with a thought and then let it carry you forward?
Well, you can do it either way or probably 100 different other ways. For me, I like to structure it. I learned structure kind of by accident. You know, there weren't really any books when I started. There was one I found that's no longer in print. Mostly I was just able to get a hold of some screenplays, none of which had been made, none of which were any good, but at least the person, you know, I could see what the rules were. And then I finally figured out, sort of by accident, after I'd gotten some things made and had success, that I was sort of intuitively following dramatic rules that have been in place since Aristotle, really, wrote them down in what's called the Poetics, the rules of drama. And they haven't changed much. I mean, experimental films may try to change them, but the way we understand movie making today and storytelling today goes back thousands of years. And once you know those principles, wherever you get them, from a modern-day writer like Sid Field or go back to Aristotle, as long as you know what those are, then you can play with it a bit, you know, but don't ever forget them. So for me, I like to outline because that allows me to always see the structure of, you know, of the story. Then within that, I let it find its own way.
And the point you just made about people getting to the third act and then just kind of dying out, that is more or less because there is not an outline to follow?
Well, that's part of it. It's possible to write a bad outline and end up in the same place. But you see, it's real simple. A movie starts with somebody who's in a relatively stable part of their life. I mean, it's nothing is happening. And then something happens, something huge that changes them and changes their circumstances. And they either then, as a result, they react by wanting to get rid of this thing, or they want to go get this thing, you know. And then the movie is all about preventing them from achieving that goal of either getting the thing they want or getting away from the thing they don't want. And then once they either, you know, reach their goal, or they don't reach it and they die in the process, because those are the only two satisfactory endings to a drama, then the story's over. But oftentimes the writers do not create a goal that is sustainable over a period of time.
Okay, let's see. Am I unmuted? Are you unmuted? We got to stop there.
I hear you. I hear you.
Here we go. You hear me?
Yes.
Unmuted.
Hey, guys.
That was great. That was great.
It was. I liked it.
That was a good call.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know,
it was fascinating.
Barry and I met for over a 4-year period at lunch. And I was driving up to Santa Barbara, sleeping in my car, and then I could go up to the coffee shop. And we actually worked out a treatment because he thought I was crazy enough to qualify for a movie.
So. Muted. Unmuted.
Well, that's true.
So, we're going to go to Whole Planet Healing. I said the wrong story. I said that was with Daphne and Terry. And maybe Daphne was on there and she asked the question at the end.
We just read, we were reading between the lines.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. It was a good one to play back.
Yeah, well, it's very good.
All right.
This session is no longer being recorded.